I've been asked to introduce myself so I could say anything I like. And you don't know whether it's true or not. As you can see, my name is Michael Coughlin. I come from Adelaide and I work most of the time with TAFE in South Australia. But I also work part-time for myself, for my own, you know, kind of e-learning consultancy role. So I do a bit of both. I work in e-learning professional development and have done for many years. So I kind of live and breathe this stuff and was in fact one of the people on the panel for the 2009 Horizon Report, Australia-New Zealand Horizon Report. Some of you may know that the Horizon Report has been around for about 5 years on an international level, and last year they decided they would try and do one in Australia and New Zealand to kind of, I'm going to use an American word, regionalise the report. And it was a great pleasure and a privilege to be on the board of both last year's and this year's. I found this preparing for this presentation quite difficult. I mean, it's what's on the horizon in terms of technology and technology and education. And I'm no expert in most of the stuff that I'm going to show you and talk about today. So if you are, or if you know more than me, please jump in and help clarify, because a lot of these things I'm still grappling with, and that's the nature of technology when we're talking about the future. I mean, it's hard enough working out the stuff that we've got now, and you look at what they're planning or predicting might be around 3 years from now, and you're just thinking, what is that? How would I possibly use it in my life or in education? So just with that kind of caveat, a lot of this is really what I've done is gone into the Horizon Report and taken a few snippets out of it, and there's a lot in there that you couldn't possibly get through in this kind of session. But what I hope at least is from this hour that you know that the Horizon Report exists. And it, really it is, if you want to kind of give yourself, well, not just entertainment in the sense of looking at what's on the horizon, but knowing as a, you know, let's say a responsible educator, what other people in this country from all sectors, schools, vet and higher ed, have said is coming, then it's a good read. And it is, as I kind of hinted, a bit of a brain exercise to look at some of this stuff. The slide on screen there is talking about the key trends from the report. So the report has a key trends section. Anything surprise you about any of those up there? It's talking about the value of innovation, the role of technology in creating community, increasingly empowers students, communicating, socializing, becoming a ubiquitous, transparent part of all our lives. And this increasing evidence of informal learning and personal learning environments, sometimes called PLEs, and adjacent to that is the e-portfolio movement. So these are some of the key trends identified by the Horizon Report Committee for this year in 2000 in Australia and New Zealand. So anything up there surprise you? Need clarifying? Okay. The way that the Horizon Reports always work is that they group the technologies into chronology, and specifically a 1 year period, a 2 to 3 year period, a 4 to 5 year period, and try and estimate, predict when the sorts of technologies that are highlighted in the report will become, in a sense, mainstream. And they do, when they say mainstream, that's, yeah, that they'll be used by us in class, in education somewhere. Yeah, down the back. It's all on a report. I mean, if you wanted to... it's on the web. It's the Horizon Report is right there. So I'm just taking slide shots of it. I could easily have gone straight from here. So on the last slide, there is the URL to the actual report itself. So yeah, that's crucial information. Yep. And straight away when I look at this breaking up of the years ahead, I disagree. And that's the nature of this process. I think there were 37 educators from around Australia got together to go through and effectively vote for technologies. And so you start out with a very, very, very large list, and then you're asked to cull it. And we come all the way back and have just two technologies mentioned for each of the time frames. And in the from now to 1 year away, it was said, according to this year's report, that mobile internet devices will become mainstream, and so will private clouds. I have no issue with private clouds, and I think you could argue straight away that mobile internet devices are already part of a lot of people's activity in mainstream education. So there has been collective subjective judgments made here, so none of this is, you know, hard, cold fact, and you can disagree, and there's no right or wrong either. So I don't think that all of these things are in the right place, but I'm just one of 37 people, and this was the collective opinion of everybody. Well, we're going to get into clouds in a minute. So they were the first two mentioned in the first time frame, from 2 to 3 years, open content, virtual, augmented and alternate realities, 4 to 5 years, location-based learning, smart objects, smart devices. So let's pick out some of, well, at least define or try and define what each of them are. Mobile internet devices is the first one off the rank, and most of us would have a fairly good, well, reasonable general knowledge at least about the sorts of things that are possible with mobile internet devices. And look, there's not much they can't do, frankly. And I've just pulled out a couple of examples that have been mentioned in the report. You can now get a Google Sky Map if you're using Google's Android phone. Serves as a mobile planetarium if you are a student or someone interested in history. You can get maps of the world containing full-colour historical maps. You can have a little device which tells you if you have an earthquake what it was on the Richter scale. Woohoo! Just what you need wandering around downtown Sydney or anywhere else in Australia, but might be a fun party toy every now and then. Reference works such as the Australian Dictionary, Aussie Slang Dictionary, and so on. There's hundreds, and I have noticed, as you probably have too, on TV recently, there's new advertising with the Apple iPhone. And anyone remember the number of applications they advertise in that little ad on TV? How many applications there are for the iPhone? 90,000. Just a mere 90,000. This one piqued my interest, something with the unpronounceable name of the KNFB reader, is designed to help those with learning disabilities or visual impairment. The user snaps a picture of text using his or her mobile phone, and the phone converts the text to speech. We can't show a demo of this in action, and that's one of the other things that, with a lot of the things mentioned in the Horizon report, you go to the website hoping to see examples of them, and you get a description, because really they're only in prototype, or there's very few living examples available. So I can't really tell you much more about this one, except that's what it does. So you would hold your phone against a piece of text, and I guess that could be a screen, and it actually takes a photograph of the text it sees, and then it reads it back to you. Probably, yeah. And then, of course, there's all these questions of cost, and but we won't get bogged down in all of that. This is where we kind of like think visionarily and just wax lyrical about what things we can do. Cloud computing. So the example, or the actual category, was labelled private cloud computing, and let's just look at what cloud computing is, first of all. So we're going to look at a short video which talks about... No, we're not going to do that yet. What cloud computing is. And I think I'll let it run for a couple of minutes. It's a 5-minute video, but I think after 2 or 3 minutes you get the idea of what it is. And for those who may already know what cloud computing is, listen anyway, or send a tweet or something.
But what does it really mean? Do you have to be sitting on a mountain with a computer among the clouds? Or on a plane with a laptop?
Can you hear that?
Does it work when it's sunny? Can you actually type on a cloud computing keyboard? Cloud computing is pretty big, and it's growing bigger every day. There are basically 3 layers to cloud computing. Companies use them differently based on what they offer. At the bottom is the foundation, the infrastructure. This is where things start and where people begin to build. This is the layer where cloud hosting lives. So let's talk about hosting in the cloud, which is an older concept that, due to technology advances, is finally starting to work really well. Let's say you are a company and you have a website. And the website has a lot of short conversations that are exchanged between members. You start with a few users talking to each other, and they start telling their friends about your site. And they tell their friends, and their friends tell their friends, and so on. You are successful. But with success can come problems. Your equipment just can't keep up with the demand. Your service slows down, and suddenly you are in trouble. A few years ago, you would have put your website on a computer or server somewhere. And when your success kicked in, you had to run around and buy or rent new servers, set them up, or have someone set them up for you. Hundreds of thousands of companies do this now. It costs a lot of money, and it takes lots of time. This is called hosting. It takes time to set them up, and they cost quite a bit of money to keep running all the time. You pay for these servers when you are using them, and you pay for them when you are not using them. You really just want to build your service and improve your product. But instead of success, the customers are getting angry, and your successful business is shrinking away. Now you have a better option, cloud computing. With cloud computing, you have access to computing power instantly when you need it. Put your website on a cloud server just like you would put it on a dedicated server. And when people start visiting your site, if you suddenly need more computing power dedicated to your website, you can scale up as much as you need almost instantly. You get your computing power as you need it from the cloud, on demand. And your customers stay happy without noticing any difference. And if your traffic dips back down, you can release your servers back into the cloud just as easily. This is a major advantage, so I'll say it again. When you need more computing power, you can get it instantly from the cloud. And when you're done with it, you release it back to the cloud. Billing is easy too. It works the same way you pay for gas or electricity. When you turn on a light, the meter starts running, and you are billed for the electrical power that you take from the power grid. And when you're done with the light, you turn it off, and the meter stops running. Or you can think of it like getting a taxi. The meter runs when you ride. It runs much slower when you stop.
Okay, I'm going to stop it there. So cloud computing basically refers to all the stuff that you need to drive, house, your IT demands is not on location in your building, in your college, in your school. It's up there somewhere. And it's already a reality with things like YouTube and Flickr and Facebook, all this content that many of us have elsewhere. It's not on our computers. It's on the internet hosted out there on the cloud or in the cloud. Private clouds are where, as it says there, a cloud computing capability dedicated to one organization. Examples of public clouds are Google Apps or Microsoft Live. Does anyone here work for an organization that already uses these? No? TAFE in South Australia has just done a deal with Microsoft, so what that means from start of semester one next year is that every student in TAFE South Australia has gigabytes of space in the Microsoft cloud. So any student who enrolls in any course is given a Microsoft email address and access to really gigabytes of space. So this whole issue of where to put stuff, particularly media, is solved. And TAFE doesn't bear the cost because they don't have those stacks of servers that you saw in that image or in that little film. Microsoft takes care of it. So you pay Microsoft, of course, for doing that. But you no longer have these banks of servers on location in your place. You host it out on the cloud. So Google Apps is the Google version, and you can see there the list, Gmail, Google Talk, etc. They are all part of the Google Cloud. So they're the public clouds. Private clouds, and again, this is where it was really difficult to find a great example, and I'm not going to click on this link here because all it does is take you to a website where you read about it. But the University of Melbourne has set up a private cloud that allows them to trial what agriculture would be like if you get access to all the data in real time. So they've done a deal with IBM. They've got a trial farm somewhere, and there's lots of instruments in this farm that measure humidity, likely rainfall, both short and long term, the state of the plant, state of the soil, whether there's any pests or other diseases around the place. So they've got all these sensors monitoring the data, which is fed back to their private cloud, which constantly processes and sends back information to the farmer about what to do. And it's resulted in this amazing increase in production in this trial farm that the University of Melbourne is running. So that's one up and running example in pilot, but how a private cloud might benefit an organisation. In the example that I mentioned with Microsoft before, or in this case? Yeah. It's still somewhere, yeah, but it's not on your computer, which is typically what we did. Some people still do, but a few years ago that's the only option you had. Now it's just easier to keep things on the internet. So what's your question exactly? It can still fail. Yeah, but how often have you known Google to fail? Or Microsoft? Where their sites are down. It's a rare event. And as someone joked recently, they said, well, won't we still have problems if Google goes down? I said, yeah, but it won't be anywhere near as long or as often. It'll be back within seconds. You know, like, so when TAFE servers go down, you know, like half a day, a week. So, yeah, things could go wrong, but I think it'll be seconds or minutes. I could be wrong. Well, again, I'm no expert on that, but I can only assume, and I certainly know personally some of the people in TAFE who've made the decision to go with Microsoft, and they wouldn't have made that decision without grilling Microsoft on all those issues. It's not an area I follow or even understand very much, but so I'm just going to trust them. Sounds like a soap. Trust me. What's interesting here, I mean, I suppose in the every one of these technologies is, what's this got to do with education? What's it got to do with me as a student or as a teacher? So, but I don't know the answer to that question, and the answer to that question is going to be different for each one of these technologies and different for each one of you. So just have that question in the back. I mean, this is a report about technology and education, but sometimes the connection between technology and education, in my opinion, is pretty tenuous. But maybe that's the nature of this sort of report. Again, wax lyrical and sort of dream. Moving on to the next time category, that of 2 to 3 years. The first one mentioned is open content. So open content is that process where educators just put any content they create, which they may use in class, on the internet for open consumption for whoever wants it. A famous example of it, which is several years old now, is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who made the decision to do this, I don't know, 5 to 8 years ago, and are famous for demonstrating that the result of that is they picked up business. They picked up bucket loads of business, because people around the world who'd never heard of Massachusetts, MIT, would be surfing the net for content. They'd find it. It was MIT content. They'd sign up. So they've proven demonstrably that if you want to improve your bottom line, rather than sit on your content and guide your IP, and I realise this is my bias, the better thing to do is put it out there, because people, large numbers of people, more than you ever dreamed of, may find it and you'll do better business. So that's part of the move behind open content. that bit there in red on the bottom, open content offers the additional promise of reaching people that are not formally enrolled in a program of study, independent, informal, just-in-time, lifelong learners. Whether or not you see it useful to kind of look after those people, and I don't know, I mean, you might be thinking, well, if they pay up, I'll help them. But see, the difference is, and it's there are organisations working like this now. They've reached the conclusion that the least valuable asset they have in this whole process of delivering educational programs is the content. So they just give that away. The next level of value is facilitation. So if you want to sign up and do a course with us, and you want to be facilitated, taught, well, that's an extra fee. And if you want a qualification that's officially recognised, that's an extra fee again. So they offer these different levels of service depending on what the individual needs. But at the basic level, open content on its own is nothing. What makes value or adds value to content is the teaching and the services that go around it. There are a few examples of places who are using it a lot. I mean, Flat World Knowledge is free online books, but it's new and there's not much there for VET that I could see. The Open Education, I can't remember what the R stands for, OER Commons, Open Education, forget, a clearinghouse of open, probably resources. Again, you can browse these if you want to chase these links yourself. Wiki Educator is one that's growing. Wiki Educator looks just like Wikipedia, except it's created by teachers. And there are teachers who, rather than when they design an online course behind a learning management system, or on bits of paper, or however else they hand it out to their students, they just design it on Wiki Educator as a fully open, public available course right from the start. And there's a few more extra points there about open content, which I have borrowed from Nancy Stanilis from Education AU. It certainly reduced the cost of education through development and sharing of content. This is particularly relevant in the developing world, where there are large amounts of the planet that they just don't have the resources or skills to develop the content we do, and they can use it. If you as a teacher go searching and find materials that already exist, you can get straight down to the teaching context of teaching rather than have to worry about the content. Yeah, true, but I think most of us, I know, most teachers always modify content. We rarely take anyone else's content and use it exactly as it is. And there's mention there of the Toolbox Repository, LAWN, the OER movement, and Creative Commons. Creative Commons, that system of licensing that allows people to use content, because when you put it on the internet, you say anyone is free to use this. Just make sure you acknowledge and attribute that it was mine. Moving on to the, well, same time frame, but the next mentioned technology, and here's where I may need some help, because I haven't yet quite sorted out in my own head what the difference is between virtual, augmented, and alternate realities. Some of you no doubt went to Joe Kay's session before lunch. Joe Kay, who's very active in Second Life, and I think largely, not just through Joe, but through people like Joe, we are now, most of us, aware of at least what Second Life is as an example of a virtual reality. And that image there, that's actually me sitting with Joe, I think, on the deck of her island. But enter these other worlds, things called augmented and alternate realities. So it includes things like just reading the bits down there in red, includes simulations and alternate reality games. And they're proving to be effective means for attracting students' interest and increasing their engagement. Would anyone care to define the difference between these three? Anyone sufficiently aware of what they are to... No? All right, we'll stumble on together. So I've mentioned Joe Cady there as an example. The other link there, Virtual Worlds Real Learning, is a wonderful case study that Gips TAFE did a couple of years ago, where they created amazing spaces. I don't know whether anyone has ever seen that the two spaces. They created a hotel that was created by their own building and construction students, and it was painted by their painting and decorating students, and it was serviced by their hospitality students, all in Second Life, in a virtual world. There are also really scary examples in there, for example, of a space they built in Second Life where it was an attempt to render a reality that someone who suffers from schizophrenia might experience. And to travel through this space is just horrific. And what it does, and it was designed for people who are working in mental health, to give people some semblance of what someone who suffers schizophrenia actually puts up with. And you only need to see it once and you think, I get it. Really, really powerful stuff that you can do where you're simulating simulating reality, I should say. Zombie Truth is a game where people can, they go and you actually have to work out. It's designed for medical students where there's a virus going around the world and there are clues all over the website and medical students have to go in there and work out why this virus is spreading and come up with a reason for a plan to stop it. Stock Track is not, this is where I think, this has been around for ages, this kind of Stock Track simulation. This is the one where you get to pretend you have shares on the stock market and you move your money around every day, and they've been doing it in school for a couple of years. And so at the end of a period, you can see whether or not you've made or lost money. So you get an experience of simulating the stock market. Now, I'm moving into this next category without sufficiently defining virtual, augmented and alternate, because I think there's some crossover here between the time frame of 2 to 3 years and the next one we move into are 4 to 5 years. So the first category in 4 to 5 years was location-based learning, which also has a very strong connection back to the first thing we looked at, mobile devices. It was 5 years ago, 7 years ago, when it wasn't this phone, but it was a mobile phone, and I was at a friend's house in Melbourne, and I rang a taxi about 11 o'clock at night, and the taxi company said, Maxwell Street, Clifton Hill, and I'm holding my mobile phone and thinking, yeah? So even then, they knew where I was because I had a mobile phone. So the idea of using the phone to track where you are, they know where you are. You've got one of these. Anyone who wants to know, they can find out any time, and they have been for a long, long time. So putting it way ahead of years into the future, relevance for teaching and learning, just-in-time content delivery, giving students access to data that is clearly tied with what they are seeing and experiencing at the moment. In the Adelaide Fringe Festival last year, you could wander around the city of Adelaide and at any given point stop and go to this web address, and they had the program basically tied to physical events. That is, you'd stop, do a search for the Fringe, and if there was an event over there in that building, it would tell you what event was on right there. So that was done last year in the Adelaide Fringe Festival. So again, not new, but it's that kind of thing, where students are out there and using a phone or similar, basically everything is annotated. And someone actually said yesterday that it won't be long before I can actually hold up my phone and scan you, and it will tell me who you are, where you work, any other data that it's got off the internet. Look, I don't know if that's true, but that's what someone else was saying. Augmented reality. Okay, and there's an example of that coming up soon. So that's where you're using a device like this and it basically translates or codes whatever it's in front of you and adds extra information. How long have we got? 5 seconds or 10? How long before the billboard starts doing that? Yeah. Sixth Sense technology. I've stuck the reference on the end because I saw that too and thought, wow. We're jumping ahead a bit here, but you've got a device here and it allows you to hold up your hands, take a photo, and there's the photo. So it's going, it's, you're framing an image for this thing, which has taken the photograph for you. Did we have an example? I think layer.com was worth looking at here. So I'm going to click on this link. So what's going on here is that the person in this car or on this bicycle has a device which is tracking where they are. And you can see that this information is saying they're going at 80 k's per hour. They'll be arriving in 1 second, and they're there. This is just the next example. He'll be there in 2 seconds. He's got this location device on for 16 minutes. So what this is a thing that they've invented that you can put it on, or your person, stick it in the car with you, and if it's useful for someone to know where you are for a period of 15 minutes, they can know exactly where you are. So if someone's expecting you, you know, for a cup of tea on a Sunday afternoon, they can say, oh, they're 3 minutes away. Just like you can actually now go to the bus stop sometimes and see, oh, the bus is 3 minutes away or it's running 10 minutes late. So we'll be able to do this with each other very shortly. So it's to check up on people rather than Yeah, they need to know where their salesmen are in case they have an accident and they get quick help. But it does raise the issue, of course. Thank you for that. So Optus already rolling this out to companies who want to use this technology to track where their salespeople are. And we cross over into this territory, obviously, how of surveillance and where things can be used for good or for not so good. But this would be fun, wouldn't it? Just to get... No? I can see where you are. What was that? Yeah, so relevance for learning. I mean, I've actually read what the Horizon Report said and thought, well, none of that leaps out at me. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just kind of couldn't immediately make sense of it in my context. Anyone see something you think, ah, yeah, that would be good for, yeah? Yeah, I think it's really exciting to think that students could be out in the field with a device no bigger than this, and they've got just access to tons and tons of information about what's there in their immediate world. Okay. Moving on to the next time frame. Or was it the same time frame? Same time frame. The next item on the list is smart objects and devices, and this is where I disagree with the time frame. Has anyone already used LiveScribe? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4 people, 5 people here at 6. So I just think they've got that wrong. Well, you know, we collectively put this in the wrong place. All right, so it's 4 to 5 years till mainstream use, but I know people are already using this in their daily working life. LiveScribe is a tool that is a microphone, essentially, and as I write on this special paper, it's recording every sound I make. So later, when you go back to that paper and you put your pen top on top of the word you were writing at the time I was talking, it immediately plays back the audio associated with that exact moment. So where people are finding it fantastic is people who regularly take minutes in meetings. They no longer have to make copious notes and they can go back later and just hear it all. They just hear it all with the notes they make. And, of course, the art of note-taking for students would be a wonderful boon, though it's not, interestingly, a straightforward comparison. Has anyone tried, of the people who've already got one, tried note-taking with these things? What have you found? Have you found any difference in the way you take notes compared to what you might have done before? Okay, that's a bit different from... I found it quite difficult initially because I take notes a certain way and all of a sudden I don't have to do it with this. I can just write one word for a whole sentence. So tip, if you're using LiveScribe, try the mind mapping approach. Yeah, has anyone faced that issue and done something like ask permission. It's a good point. Yeah. And you're just a TAFE person? So I presume you haven't got permission from your lecturer to record them? So you've got a record. We're surrounded by these issues daily with new technology. Thanks for that. That's useful to know. The next example there on the screen is a Kindle, an e-book reader. Anyone got one of those? You can get them here, but the difficulty is getting stuff onto them. You can, So that's available in Australia now. But obviously the technology's... When I first looked at Kindles, I thought, no way. Because I imagined sitting outside somewhere in a comfy chair or under a tree with something which, you know, a book. And then I saw someone using one of these on a plane and I thought, that looks pretty good. It's about the same size as a paperback book. It's very light. It's very thin. And they were just sitting there very casually, kind of reading. Just press the button for the next page. Just reading. Boom. So, gee, that looks easy. So there's an issue in Australia at the moment of getting the content onto your Kindle. But I think that's a short-lived problem. But other issues are, like with the iPhone, mentioned the applications that are available for the iPhone. The iPhone screen's not that much smaller than a Kindle. And some people are saying Kindles and e-book readers are going to disappear because the iPhone and the light will do it all. We'll wait and see. Staying in that same time frame of 4 to 5 years, let's have a look at something which, yeah, quite futuristic, a little movie called, or something about something called Siftables. I queued this one earlier. This is from TED Talks, and I just want to plug TED Talks. If you don't already know TED Talks, you know, we've all got lots of spare time, but if you do have, and you feel like going to some place that might have something inspiring, TED Talks just has tons of stuff. They have seminars in lots of countries, and they tend to handpick the best speakers on the best topics to do with education, in particular education technology, and it's just a wonderful place to hear some of the best speakers in the world on stage presenting, and again, it's all free. So this is a guy talking about Siftables.
I want to start by asking you to think back to when you were a kid playing with blocks. As you figured out how to reach out and grasp, pick them up and move them around, you were actually learning how to think and solve problems by understanding and manipulating spatial relationships.
We'll have to leave it on small screen.
How we understand a lot of the world around us. So, as a computer scientist, inspired by this utility of our interactions with physical objects, along with my advisor, Patty, and my collaborator, Jeevan Kalanithi, I started to wonder, what if, when we use a computer, instead of having this one mouse cursor that was like a digital fingertip moving around a flat desktop, what if we could reach in with both hands and grasp information physically, arranging it the way we wanted? This question was so compelling that we decided to explore the answer by building Siftables. In a nutshell, a Siftable is an interactive computer the size of a cookie. They're able to be moved around by hand, they can sense each other, they can sense their motion, and they have a screen and a wireless radio. And most importantly, they're physical, so like the blocks, you can move them just by reaching out and grasping. And the Siftables are an example of a new ecosystem of tools for manipulating digital information. And as these tools become more physical, more aware of their motion, aware of each other, and aware of the nuance of how we move them, we can start to explore some new and fun interaction styles. So I'm going to start with some simple examples. This Siftable is configured to show video. And if I tilt it in one direction, it'll roll the video this way. If I tilt it the other way, it rolls it backwards. And these interactive portraits are aware of each other. So if I put them next to each other, they get interested. If they get surrounded, they notice that too. They might get a little flustered. and they can also sense their motion and tilt. So one of the interesting implications on interaction we started to realize was that we could use everyday gestures on data, like pouring a color the way we might pour a liquid. So in this case, we've got three septables configured to be paint buckets, and I can use them to pour color into that central one where they get mixed. We overshoot, we can pour a little bit back. There are also some neat possibilities for education, like language and math and logic games, where we want to give people the ability to try things quickly and view the results immediately. So here I'm... This is a Fibonacci sequence that I'm making with a simple equation program. Here we have a word game that's kind of like a mashup between Scrabble and Boggle. Basically, in every round, you get a randomly assigned letter on each septable. And as you try to make words, it checks against the dictionary. And after about 30 seconds, it reshuffles, and you have a new set of letters and new possibilities to try. Thank you. So these are some kids that came on a field trip to the Media Lab, and I managed to get them to try it out and shoot a video. They really loved it. And one of the interesting things about this kind of application is that you don't have to give people many instructions. All I have to say is, make words, and they know exactly what to do. So here's another few people trying it out.
That's nearly done.
That's our youngest beta tester down there on the right. Turns out all he wanted to do was to stack the septables up. So to him, they were just blocks.
And so they are. They're just blocks. I mean, in that category again of, well, okay, computer's the size of a cookie. What do you do with that in a teaching situation? I don't know. I guess it will become clear. Anyone have any big ideas right there? Just watching that, thinking, yes, I could use it for electrical engineering, for And presumably you'd get some indication of whether it was correct or whether it works. Yep. Now, Tweeterwatts are kind of in the silly category. Twitter, I'm assuming that most of you will know, is that new microblogging or micro-messaging tool. And a tweet is something that you send on Twitter, and so the link has gone to somewhere else now. Let's see if I can find the Twitter what. This is obviously something that updates. The URL has not changed, but the content that we're going to, just go back in case. Here it is there. So I mean, I suppose if you're really into saving energy and living green, what this is a gadget that you plug in. I'm still waiting for the file to load, so I can't bring it up on... There we go. It looks like that. It's like an electrical device. You plug it in, it's plugged into your household appliances, and it monitors how much electricity you're using and sends a message to Twitter about how much energy you're using. So your friends on your network know, and I guess you could use it as a competition or something, or kids in different houses, you could have a competition about saving energy, but that's a tweet or what. Okay, we're nearly at the end. So I'm just going to tell you about this. We mentioned him earlier. He's the guy who wears something around his neck and takes photographs just by holding his fingers up like so. And this is not part of the Horizon report. I only found this a couple of weeks ago, and obviously people like you did too, and this guy's been hailed as a leading thinker in technology in India, and as the gentleman over here mentioned, he's said that it's going to be open source. So he's putting all his intellectual property around this technology into the open source area, which means no one profits and everybody learns. So I That's amazing, actually, this little video. I know that's a big, fat slide full of text, but it's kind of my summary of not just to do with technology, but what the technology is doing to the way we live and the impact that has on us as teachers and educators and administrators, managers, when connected people start coming into our workplaces. So I might just be silent for a minute or two to allow you to read that. I can read it. So for those who... I had a discussion about this earlier with someone, and well, it's... I just find it interesting that people can not use PowerPoint or any visual aid, and they can give a talk for 45 minutes and no one cares. The moment you put some text on a PowerPoint slide and read it, people object, because somehow you... It's like in, I don't know, I'm going to read it. So if you don't want me reading the text that's on this slide, don't look at the slide. And just pretend that I'm talking without a slide. Organisations will need to adapt to the fact that Web 2 citizens will enter places of work and learning highly connected to a network of peers that they rely on for entertainment, mutual learning and collaboration. They may expect to be able to make use of these personal learning and social networks and the technologies that make these networks possible in their places of work or study. These Web 2 citizens operate in a world that is open and mobile, and they are unlikely to accept authority that is automatically assigned to a position. The world is flat and devoid of hierarchy. In a world where information about their areas of interest or expertise is increasing exponentially, they will place greater store on connected networks, which may extend beyond classroom or workplace boundaries, and knowing where to get the knowledge and information they need is more important than knowing that knowledge and information themselves. So whether we're talking about siftables or Kindles, it's a technology-mediated world that people have access to. And the challenge for organisations, workplaces, schools, colleges, TAFEs, is that in the past we were able to ordain, this is what we use. And everyone was pretty happy with that. Now, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous for an organisation to say, this is what we're using, because everybody's already using all this other stuff at home. And it's just as ridiculous to say that we're going to cater for everything, because they can't do that either. So the role of the individual, the personal learning environment, and the technologies that enable that has to be acknowledged by the organisation, whether it's a school or a TAFE or a uni or a workplace. People are going to bring their own technology and their own networks into the world of work and study. And I think that's personally, I think, the biggest challenge that this technology presents to all of us. The technology, in a sense, is irrelevant. The effect it has on the relationships between the organisation and the individual are profound. And I think that's it. Thank you.